in it, what's in it for me? Am I growing? Who am I? What do I need? What do I want? What do I desire? Almost a worship of our somebodyness. I have a right to be somebody. And that came out of years of feeling you didn't. Of carrying around the feeling I'm powerless and something I'm wrong because I'm not the whole universe like I used to be, which you experienced as a baby. It must be incredibly painful. The moment not just of physical birth, but of psychological birth, of the experience of separateness as an entity when you have been the whole thing. I've described in many lectures and on tape, and I can't do the whole story, but the experience in Hawaii with that community of meditators in Hawaii, where finally they had pushed me to my limits, and they all had their hands on my body, and I was screaming and screaming and screaming as to their orders. And suddenly I was back in a crib in my room at home, and I was screaming the same way, and my mother was holding me down, just had her hand on my chest. I was having a temper tantrum, obviously, of some sort, and she was just being a good mother. She wasn't giving way to it. She wasn't reinforcing temper tantrums, which you didn't do in those days. Later you did, and look what happened. But she didn't, and she wasn't out of I'm a mean mother. She was just calming me down, but it was firm. And the firmness had a resistance to my power. I couldn't control the situation anymore. And the experience was one of loss of power. And when I see, when I look at business, and I look at government, and I look into the personalities of all of the politicians, and don't you see all that fear, and don't you see all that sense of not being powerful enough, and that if I had the power, it would all be all right? It's we are caught in a drama so thick of ego structures, ego constructs that have come out of our intellectual extrapolations from our basic root conceptual models of who am I and how the world works. Which has to do with fear, it has to do with feelings of pain of separateness, it has to do with power. It has to do with a yearning to come back to a certain feeling at home in the universe, at om, at one. And I think most of what we live with in politics, in business, in most of our professions, most of our lifestyles, deeply. Poem by Rumi. The minute I heard my first love story, I started looking for you, not knowing how blind that was. Lovers don't finally meet somewhere. They are in each other all along. That last line, interesting. The minute I heard my first love story, I started looking for you, not knowing how blind that was. Lovers don't finally meet somewhere. They are in each other all along. This year, last year it was two planes, any two. This year, I'm pushing 3 planes. Out of the infinite variety of planes, I'm just pushing 3. One is what we would call the ego plane. And that will include the physical, mental, and emotional bodies. Then we'll call the second one the soul plane. And that will include the way in which you are a somebody awareness. You're still somebody. You are an entity with unique karma. And the third plane is the plane of pure awareness, which is really not a plane, but we'll use the word planes now. We could use spheres, but we'll just use planes for fun. Don't think that planes mean higher is better. They're just different from one another. So if I were to review our storyline thus far from, let's say, the soul's point of view, the middle level, I would say I had some business to do, which we will call karma, psychic DNA, some ill-digested attachments, aversions and attractions. And that karma led to the manifestation of me in a physical form. In other words, I took birth in an incarnation. And when I was born, I was still fully out there with my karma to run through, of course. But that karma involved a certain experience of socialization. And in that process, I knew ultimately of my separateness. I experienced my separateness from God or from all or from something. In other words, I began to get attached to the form in which I had manifested. I'm now speaking as a soul. Now, as I get sort of encrusted into a form, there is a kind of a moment of incredible fear when the form starts to solidify enough so there's a boundary, so there is a form and other. There is and other. You pinch your toe and you pinch the bedpost and they're different, and you keep pinching and pinching and pinching and pinching, and you're learning that's me and that's not me, or something like that. Now, it can be as early as when you leave the womb. It could be that separation. Or it could be the separation when you first experience sucking and there's no milk coming. That is, when you experience the separateness so that the universe isn't all one thing anymore. There's an awareness that there's something separate. You have separated. And you have gotten caught in a part of the universe rather than the awareness you are the whole universe. So you have, what Gurdjieff talks about, been imprisoned. Was that I had trapped her in being that Jewish middle class, nurturing, very responsible mother. And that was just who she had incarnated as. And he was saying she's a great being. And suddenly, at that moment, there was a figure ground reversal, and the very few, maybe 4 or 5 times in our life that I could remember, when there had been that reversal and where we had recognized one another as fellow beings. One example that I always use is she and I were coming back from the dentist's. I was maybe 9 or so. And we came to a stoplight and we were playing a game to see who could hold a note the longest. And we were both screaming at the top of our lungs. And we looked over, and there was a man in the next car looking at us as if we were both completely insane. And there was a moment when our whole game of mother and child dissolved into the hate of the moment. And at that moment, we were outside of our roles for a moment and then back in. And those were so few, and yet they had existed. And it's interesting, after he said that, ever after, that's who she and I have been with one another. And all that other stuff has disappeared or dissolved into the ground. And it's why I say to people when they're grieving, you're grieving for all the forms of the incarnation. But why you're grieving is because you connected with love to the deeper nature of the other person. And when you stop filling your mind with your self-pity, anger, hope, fear, wishing, and quiet, you experience nothing happened. Nobody went anywhere. It is merely because I've measured you in terms of your forms. I've reduced you into form. And now you're dead and you up-leveled me. You said, find me now. Go ahead. You really love me? Find me. And you keep wanting the form back because that's the one that turns you on. But ultimately, you have to turn on from somewhere else. Otherwise, you're always desperate for external rushes. So the awakening is an awakening. Could be said to be, I mean, the word awakening is used in the spiritual literature, could be said to be the moment when you realize you're in prison. The moment when you experience another reality. The moment when you see there are other ways of looking at it all. I mean, really other. Really other. I'm not talking about other places in your thought process, but other. Now, what you call that place from which you look at your life when before you were just busy thinking you were it, your incarnation life, where do you look at it from? And that's where we're using the word soul, which could, at the deepest levels of the use of the word witness, could be that, but usually it isn't. Now let's look at the soul's predicament. The soul had some karma to work out, took an incarnation, got lost in the incarnation, and then starts to awaken and realize that it has just taken an incarnation, and it had to get lost and go through the whole process of awakening for the incarnation to work out the karma. This is not an error in the system. The predicament of the word soul is that it's got all kinds of a Christian overlay. I guess it's got Jewish overlay and probably every other religious overlay too. I don't mean to lay it on the Christians. Just that they are so soulful. And actually, that's because that plane is a wonderful leverage plane to get able to see the plane you've been stuck on. It's a very useful plane. It's like a step in a ladder, and it allows you to take your pressure off your foot on the lower rung because you're on the middle rung. So that you could say that one of the ways of awakening is you awaken to realize you are a soul that has been lost for quite a while. Deeply, deeply emerged in these particular conceptual plane of reality that everybody conspires to see as real. Like in the book I'm doing with aging, it's absolutely amazing how this society conspires to define what aging is and then sucks everybody into believing it's true and then they live it out. And it's a hype. It is a complete hype. It's a creation of mind. So that if you look at aging, in almost all the literature, it is seen as a problem. That's the first one. Isn't that bizarre? You know, it's like the leaves turn red in the fall and you say, we got a problem. Let's get out there with a green can and paint them all green. What the hell? We can't have these leaves turning red. What's that about? It's so absolutely bizarre. Bizarre. The first thing you have to realize is you're in prison. You've been had. You bought into a conceptual model that you got trained into from birth to deal with your separateness, and it's a whole structure that you've invested with reality. And from your point of view, it's the only reality most of the time. When my father would say, Richard, come back to reality, that's the one he meant. Now, where are all the other planes of reality when we're so busy investing in this one rather uninteresting plane? It's not uninteresting. It's actually passionately beautiful, but it's also uninteresting. If it's your only one, it's a very sparse. It's like having not having cable. But the minute you realize you are in prison, that's the relative reality perception. You realize you got a problem. You realize there's more than one channel. You realize there's another place from which to look. However you want to say it, you understand the theory of relativity. You understand that everything is real depending on where you're looking at it from. Just like you dreamt last night, and in that dream, that stuff was real. And you woke up, and then you said, I woke up into what? I mean, you ultimately must realize you just woke up into another one of them. Didn't the one you were in last night seem real? Didn't it seem like you were in a hall with all those people? And then you woke up, and they're all gone. Still here. Long dream. And once I had realized that I was in prison, which is what my first mushroom trip absolutely ascertained for me with certainty, or as certain as relative reality can get, I looked back at all the years in which I had taken it all so, quote, seriously. And I thought, didn't I have any clues, any of those years? I mean, did I go 30 years without a clue that I was caught in some weird psychosis, group psychosis? At that time, I didn't quite see it. Over the years, I began to see that as my vision of where I was looking from changed, then a number of things that had been in the background in my life started to come out as figure. And things that were figures started to recede into background, and suddenly I could see that there was a web of that information and that wisdom available, but I was busy not seeing it because of the intense nature of the plane I was seeing. The interesting example of that that predicament was the one in which my guru said to me on the second time I saw him after the first day he told me how my mother had died. The second day he said, your mother is a great saint. And I said, didn't Maharaji say was a great saint? And the translator asked Maharaji. Maharaji said, no, is a great saint. And she was dead. So she was a dead great saint. So what was that? And what I experienced at the moment he said that was the realization that my mother wasn't who I had thought she was. By your own mind in some way. I mean, this is the mind that's done this. Because the hunger was so strong and it wasn't being fulfilled and there was pain. And these learnings are very deep when there is an emotional component to them. And most of us got very deeply socialized into being somebody, into our incarnation. It's as if there is a, when you take an incarnation, and I'm just going out, this is advanced course. When you take an incarnation, there is, it's like getting into a spacesuit. And the whole program for running that spacesuit on this plane of existence, physical, mental, emotional, social, psychological, that whole mechanism is something that is like software in the system, and it has to be developed. You develop the software, and that happens through your DNA code, through your socialization process, through all the people you meet and talk to. But notice an interesting thing, that your whole sense of separateness is really rooted from some uncomfortable experience of being separate. In other words, you didn't jump into separateness as a celebration for the most part. You were kind of pushed into separateness. Maybe you would have jumped a moment later, and maybe you did jump, and that's just the experience you had was one of pushing against it. As you obviously did, and I did. The other day, when I was thinking back over all of this in my life, I can experience that the power of my mother to deliver milk to me and keep me fulfilled, dry and warm and loved. I traced how the separation from my ability to be that, so that I got into separateness, so that I tried to control it. So as soon as you become somebody, you get into a power thing, because as a somebody, as a baby, you're awfully little. And the forces around you are very big. And so I somehow experience in myself having experienced the pain of separateness and having not the power to control that. That I couldn't get what I wanted when I wanted it. Once I became a somebody who wanted something. And I only became the somebody who wanted something because I didn't have what I wanted all the time. I hadn't even had a want up until then. I had to learn wants, by the way. I wanna. And really, most of my life, from all my education, because these were all surrogates for that power person that held the control of my being. And I developed, as you did, incredible skills of looking into other people's eyes to know who you were. Am I good? Am I enough? Am I achieving? Am I successful? Am I beautiful? Am I fulfilling? Am I attractive? Am I smart enough? Whatever judgmental thing you imposed on yourself. And I on myself. And I kept trying to be satisfied all the time through various things, but notice how all of it, all of my separateness was built on relationship. My relationship with my mother, with my father, with my surrogates, with all of the things that then became so on, and how much the whole web of what I call my ego is basically relational. So, for example, I'm working on the field of aging now, on conscious aging. And what I notice is the karmic effect of that in old people when they end up feeling lonely, isolated, lack of self-respect, da, 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 da. That's the whole chronicle of things that are primarily relational things. And they are suffering because of them, because of their identification with that. And as you know my story, I guess I would have continued to be that somebody, having then been trained, as you know, in somebody's specialness, just like you were. So we aren't just somebody, we're somebody special. And then we all go around being somebody special. And when Maharaji said to me, Ram Dass, don't you see it's all perfect? He was saying, hey, couldn't you come up for air for a second? You know, couldn't you come out and play a little bit? And I'm saying, no, it's real. Damn it, it's wrong. It's bad. There's good and there's evil, and this is evil. And he's saying, we'll wait. You know, he's flipping through the deck of incarnations and seeing that about 100,000 incarnations down the line, I will say, oh, God, you were high. But he's in no rush. Where's he going to go? I mean, when souls look at people who are busy being egos, just realize how poignant it all looks. How poignant it all looks. And you love the person, but you love the soul, and the storyline is so poignant. But my storyline's poignant. I mean, my storyline's no more interesting to me than yours is to me. It's all vitally interesting. It is, and it's all empty. I'll give you vital if you'll allow empty. If you don't buy empty, you can't have vital. See, if you don't understand what I'm saying, you've got two choices. Either I'm insane or you are. And I haven't the faintest idea. I wish I could help you. Because it seems real to me, what I'm saying to you. So good luck. The fun is that when the hubbub and clamor of ego entrapment gets lightened, and I mean lightened so that you're not pushing against it, but so you're really in it, but you're not caught in it. Like taking care of my father through the years of his last years was going from being caught in doing it from one level, which was ego level, slowly to extricating until we were souls just completing the business of ego and incarnation together. So as it gets lighter, not through avoidance, but lighter through harmoniously fulfilling one's dharma, fulfilling one's stuff on earth, doing what your thing is, hearing your uniqueness and manifesting, just not getting caught in it. As you get lighter into all of that, then the soul's initial business comes to light, which is its relationship to the one, or to the non, blah, no words, what the finger's pointing at. The finger of religion points at something. It's the mystery. It's the relation of the soul to the mystery. And that ultimately is the only game in town. That's the language of the mystic poetry. It's the language of the soul yearning to be with God, to be in God, to be one with what is, to be beyond boundary, to ultimately rend the strings that keep a boundary between something and something else. In other words, it's to become in love, which is boundaryless. It is to die into love. And what's happened, if you notice the sequence, is you went from one into soul. Soul took birth into separate caughtness. Separateness awakes to soul. And then when soul is in harmony, got its act together, then soul's yearning for the coming back out of its own ultimate separateness that's created by the karmic structure of it all, then it starts to come back into the one. And that yearning is the call towards the beloved. And many of you know, because I've read this at almost every retreat, these words from Ananda Mayima. She said, this body has lived with father, mother, husband, and all. This body has served the husband, so you may call it a wife. It has prepared dishes for all, so you may call it a cook. It has done all sorts of scrubbing and menial work, so you may call it a servant. But if you look at the thing from another standpoint, you will realize that this body has served none but God. For when I served my father, mother, husband, and others, I simply considered them as different manifestations of the Almighty and served them as such. When I sat down to prepare food, I did so as if for God. Whatever I did in a spirit of divine service. Hence, I was not quite worldly, though always engaged in household affairs. I had but one ideal, to serve all as God, to do everything for the sake of God. Now, can you hear? There's the whole ego storyline going. Bengali woman, wife, does it all. But she's on the level of soul, doing her life as an offering to bring her to the beloved. When Hanuman is with Ram, and Ram says to Hanuman, "Who are you, Hanuman?" And Hanuman says, "When I don't know who I am, I serve you. When I know who I am you." Okay? Now we're talking about the second and the third planes that I'm asking you to consider. Because the second plane is the soul, and you and I are fellow souls that have taken incarnation, and we're meeting in this room in Marin with our storylines coming from distances, all of our life stuff. And we're souls coming to meet as it's a convention. It's a party of souls. It's a party of souls. And we're meeting each other through our psyches and personalities and stuff. But behind it, we're laughing. Far out. What happened to you this trip?
Well, I really had. You should have seen the...
My God, what happened in my childhood, you wouldn't believe. I've been milking it for 30 years. I'm a fierce player, by the way. Don't make friends with an elephant trainer unless you have room for an elephant in your living room. That's a great Hindu line, isn't it? Are you looking for me? I am in the next seat. My shoulder is against yours. You will not find me in stupas, nor in Indian shrine rooms, nor in synagogues, nor in cathedrals, not in masses, nor kirtans, nor in legs winding around your neck, nor in eating nothing but vegetables. When you really look for me, you will see me instantly. You will find me in the tiniest hour of time. Kabir says, "Student, tell me, what is God?" God is the breath inside the breath. And so the predicament between the second and third planes that I'm asking you to consider is that the second has this intense yearning to merge back into the beloved. And as that merging occurs, the next surrender, the next death, if you will, it's not a ripping, it's just a movement into, there is the realization that God has been all of it all along. That final plane is something that includes everything. It excludes nothing. You could call that third plane, and we will for this weekend, awareness. Awareness. See, go back inside yourself. In a few moments, we're going to meditate together. So you have to do it heavy now. Just hear the method. You go back inside yourself. And you sit down so that the trauma of your ego story quiets down just a little bit. And then you begin to feel the awareness, the presence of soul, which is still you.